Thank you so much for having me, and thank you all for coming and for being here today. My name is Shireen. I'm not affiliated with any groups, any political groups in Yemen. My work is in education, so I'm actually not researching Yemen as a career. I'm not getting money for this or for any other thing that I do related to Yemen. My concern is as a private citizen and as a somebody who has family in Yemen. It's my country of birth. In fact, this is where I was born. This is a picture of Aden in South Yemen, where I was born and where I spent part of my childhood. And like you heard in the introduction, before the age of 10, I had already lived through two civil wars. And what's happening right now is incredibly destructive and doesn't compare to what I had gone through, which was traumatizing, and I still live through to this day. And so my being here and speaking out about Yemen is because I wanted to do something, wanted to speak out, since so few people have been speaking out about this incredibly important topic. I realize people really don't know where Yemen is or anything really related to Yemen, and that's totally okay. Don't feel like, you know, you should have known something about Yemen. It's okay. Oftentimes people say that I'm the first person from Yemen that they had met. And so I'm happy to guide you through some quick facts and show you some maps, you know, orient ourselves to the place in the region, and then we'll get into how this conflict started, what the U.S. role is, and the humanitarian impact that the war has had on people, but end with ways that we can act and we can bring about change. So this is a map of the Arabian Peninsula. Yemen sits to the south of the Arabian Peninsula, with Saudi Arabia to the north, Oman to the east, the Red Sea to the west, and it's very close to the Horn of Africa. Zooming in a little bit on Yemen, the capital of Yemen is Sana'a, and Aden over here is the picture that I just showed you where I was born. The population of Yemen is 28 million people, which is roughly the same population as Saudi Arabia, despite it being a much smaller country. 43% of the population is under 15 years of age. The official language is Arabic. Most of the population is Muslim, with Zaydi Muslims making up approximately 35 to 40% of the population. This will start to be relevant later on when we talk about whether this issue is sectarian or not. And there are small populations of Jewish, Hindu, Christian, and Baha'i groups in Yemen. Poverty in Yemen in 2015, before the war, was already extreme, with over 50% of the population living with less than $2 a day. I don't know what the figures are today, but I'd imagine they're much worse. But while Yemen is economically depressed and is, you know, the Middle East's poorest country, it's rich in many other ways, including its history. So here's a picture of the Temple of the Sun in Ma'rib, Yemen, and this is the Queen of Sheba, if you've heard about Queen of Sheba. She ruled from Yemen, and this is part of the excavation in northern Yemen, Temple of the Sun. There are many other historical sites in Yemen that are over 3,000, 4,000 years old. Yemen also has unique geography. You'll find everything from highlands, deserts, and even exotic beaches. This is the island of Socotra that is south of Yemen, and it's known for its unique biodiversity. We're also known for our architecture, which is very different from other neighboring countries. This is a UNESCO World Heritage Site in the old city of Sana'a. Here's another picture of that. And these are considered the world's first skyscrapers, and they're also in Yemen, and it's also a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And for the coffee lovers out there, if you like coffee, you have Yemenis to thank, because while Ethiopians were the first to discover the plant, the Yemenis were the first to brew it and then to export it to the rest of the world. And if you're familiar with the name mocha, which now means chocolate coffee combination, the word mocha is a port in Yemen, where coffee used to be exported out of. And this man right here is trying to bring Yemeni coffee back to the United States. He's a Yemeni American. It's very expensive, given what he has to go through to bring coffee here right now. But check him out if you're interested. In order to understand what the conflict is and how we got here, it's important to look back at Yemen's modern history. And if you look at an old map, you'll see that Yemen is divided into two portions, north and south. So it's really west and east, but we call it north and south. So northern Yemen, what used to be called northern Yemen, is where 80% of the population lives. And in south Yemen, most of that area is desert, and about 20% of the population lives there. What was called North Yemen was under the control of the Ottoman Empire until the end of World War II. Then they were ruled by the Mutawakkilite Kingdom of Yemen from 1918 until the revolution in 1962, and it became the Yemen Arab Republic from 1962 until 1990, where both South and North Yemen united as one.
Was that the socialist?
No, so this is not the socialist. The socialist country was in the south, South Yemen, with the capital Aden, where I was born. It was under British rule from 1874 to 1963. And following that, it became known as the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. It was a Marxist socialist government. And they united with northern Yemen in 1990 to form the Republic of Yemen, which is what we have now. So, unfortunately, the unity between north and south didn't, you know, people weren't happy about it. People from the south weren't very happy about it. And within 4 years, a civil war broke out between north and south. The north, being the more dominant country, won. And many people in South Yemen consider that they're living under occupation by the north. And so there's a lot of disenfranchisement, you know, and the alliances that have been forming are still a reflection of what happened in 1994. So oftentimes you'll hear about Yemen being referred to as a civil war. And yes, the crisis in Yemen began as a civil war. It began when various factions were vying for power, and we'll go over that very briefly. But essentially, in 2015, with Saudi Arabia's intervention, it can no longer fairly be called a civil war, because you have a coalition of international countries, foreign countries, attacking one country, which is Yemen. And so it's still referred to as civil war, but it's a bit misleading to think of it that way. Who's fighting whom, and who are the major political groups in Yemen? There is the UN-recognized legitimate president of Yemen, and this is Hadi, President Hadi. He is based in Saudi Arabia, Riyadh, and has been there for the past 3 years. Then there's a group called the Houthi Rebels, and I'll go over who they are very briefly. There's also Yemen's ex-president Saleh, who had ruled the country for 33 years, and he has, until his death in 2017, December 2017, just a few months ago, his party was very dominant in Yemen, and it remains very dominant. There's the Islah Party, which is basically the Muslim Brotherhood of Yemen, and they are connected to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And then there are the separatists in the south, who are trying to secede from the north altogether. So a brief Houthi Saleh history. The Houthis they call themselves Ansarullah, and they're from a northern province of Sa'da. They had been talking, started off preaching in mosques about, issues that they had with the Yemeni government. President Saleh was very willing to have Americans come in and drone Yemen, for example. He was willing for the Saudis to intervene in local political conflicts. And this started off as their, a populist movement that was against any foreign intervention. So he saw that as a threat. And even though they're both from the same sect of Zaydi Islam, he waged war against the Houthis in six different wars from 2004 to 2011 and was unsuccessful in defeating them. In fact, they continued to grow in popularity. They ended up joining the opposition in 2011 against Saleh, but then they ended up forming an alliance with him later on. And then when that alliance ended in 2017, it led to clashes that resulted in his death. But essentially, and I'm going to go through a brief timeline shortly, but why is Saudi Arabia bombing Yemen? Well, the Houthis were the only group who was saying, well, we don't want any foreign intervention. And Saudi Arabia, for the first time, was going to lose control in Yemen. It wasn't going to have a government that was willing to support its interests in the region. So they panicked. But the roots can be traced to the 2011 revolution. You've heard of the Arab Spring. Many countries started revolting against the dictators and longtime presidents. And in Yemen, we had a longtime president, 33 years. We'd have elections every now and then, but he would win with 99.9% of the vote. And although he had many supporters, he also had people who were willing to rise up against him. And It's important to note that the Yemeni revolution started off as a peaceful revolution. After the United States, per capita, Yemen is the most armed country after the United States. But this was a peaceful revolution. Unfortunately, this didn't last for very long because members of the Islah Party, who had previously been his allies, ended up joining the opposition and really hijacked the entire revolution, the People's Revolution. And he continued to refuse to step down, and the Islah Party ended up trying to assassinate Saleh. He survived with severe burns, but he survived. And that's when the revolution really ended up being just another power play among people who were, you know, the people were really not just revolting against Saleh, they were revolting against the whole entire system, but the elites, which are the Islah Party, ended up joining the opposition, joining the protesters. So in November, after his assassination attempt, Saleh ended up transferring power to his vice president of 20 years, Hadi. Here's a picture of him literally transferring the Yemeni flag to Hadi. So unlike other Arab Spring presidents, he had a very nice deal worked up with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries where he was to remain in Yemen. He wasn't going to be prosecuted for any crimes that he had committed. And he continued to control the Yemeni army. So Hadi was just an interim president. He was supposed to be there for 2 years. He was supposed to form some kind of unity government and rework the constitution so that everybody, all the different groups who had revolted, could come to some kind of understanding. Well, that didn't work out really because Hadi just stayed there and didn't do anything. So in September 2014, the Houthis, which was a group that was also frustrated by what was happening, the lack of action, they decided to take over the capital, Sana'a. And it wasn't really very, it wasn't a bloody clash because the Yemeni army did not intervene. And this was very surprising because the Houthis and Saleh's party were longtime enemies. But Saleh, I think, saw this as an opportunity to maybe regain some kind of power. And so he allowed the Houthis to take over Sana'a without much intervention from his army. And that month, the Houthis and the Hadi government, they signed a unity agreement, an agreement to form a unity government. So things were still looking good up until that point. That, you know, the Houthis were trying to force some action, but, you know, things were going to work out. Well, Hadi ended up resigning. First of all, his 2-year term was up, and then he resigned. And then he decided that he wasn't, you know, he changed his mind about the resignation, and then he fled to Aden. So the Houthis went chasing him. And within days, Saudi Arabia began bombing Yemen. And since this is actually a picture of Fajr al-Thani bombing, it was they had targeted a weapons depot that was right in the heart of a residential area. 150 people died, and the anniversary is actually the third anniversary is today. So the Saudi Arabia formed a coalition very quickly, and there was a lot of confusion about, well, who was in the coalition. At some point, they added Pakistan to the coalition, and Pakistan was like, we're not in the coalition, right? And so the decision to attack Yemen came 2 months after King Salman took power and appointed his son, Mohammed bin Salman, as the deputy crown prince at the time. He's now crown prince and defense minister. And Mohammed bin Salman, he's this unknown person, wanted to kind of, you know, present himself to the international community, and he figured that he could bomb Yemen for 2 weeks, reinstate Hadi to power, and get rid of the Houthis, and it'll all be over. Here we are 3 years later. So who's in the coalition? Many countries have joined the coalition. They're led by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Qatar was in the coalition up until they were expelled in June of last year after their spat with Saudi Arabia. Bahrain, Kuwait, Jordan, Morocco, Egypt, Sudan, and Senegal.
What do the Houthis stand for?
That's a really good question. I think they started off as just trying to raise more awareness among the Yemeni population about not having control over their own destiny. But they were also, I mean, the province where they're from, you know, here we have a president who's, the UN says, has $60 billion is his net worth,
Saleh.
and you know, is one of the richest men on the planet, but and the poorest country in the Middle East, and one of the poorest countries in the world, and they don't even have electricity in their province. They don't even have running water in many places. And so they were challenging, you know, the corruption that was in Yemen. And because they were openly challenging it, he saw it as a threat. So he tried to get the Saudis to help him, you know, fight off the Houthis, and then he tried to get the Americans to help him by actually telling them, oh, look, they're allied with Iran. And so that was his trick, which ended up sticking. The alliance with Iran is very shaky. There's not much evidence of really concrete ways that the Iranians have been helping. But that's how it started. And the more wars he waged on the Houthis, the more really Yemeni started becoming aware of them, and they gained more popularity that way.
And Sunni-Shia issues sometimes you
hear. Right, so which is why... I mean, that's what Saudi Arabia says, that they're fighting off, you know, Shia Iran in Yemen, and the Houthis are Shia. Well, Houthis are Zaydi Shias, yes, but so was President Saleh. And he was a longtime ally of Saudi Arabia. And he had fought against the Houthis in six wars. So it's really not a sectarian issue in Yemen. It's you know, it's a regional issue. There's, you know, the north-south divide plays into it, but not the sectarianism that you hear about in the news.
Ever had other times when they invaded or bombed and tried to take over Yemen?
So they have been involved in many ways throughout the history of Yemen, never to this extent. So in the 60s, when the North Yemenis were trying to revolt against the imams of Yemen, they worked, the Saudi Arabians trained and paid for the British soldiers to try to, you know, co-opt that revolution. In 1994, when there was a war between North and South, the Saudis took the side of the South, which ended up being the losing side. So they've always had interventions in Yemen, but never to this extent. Okay, so these are the coalition countries, officially part of the Saudi Arabian coalition. There are also some partners in this war against Yemen. And by partners, I mean these are the countries like US, UK, and France that provide logistical support, training of the troops, and so on. And then countries like Eritrea, Djibouti, and Somalia, who have made their airspaces and their bases available to the Saudi-led coalition. And then, of course, there are weapon suppliers, and this is not a comprehensive list. They have played significant role, of course, and have enriched themselves from this war on Yemen. So you have countries like Canada that had its biggest arms deals ever with the Saudi Arabians during the war on Yemen. Countries like Germany and the Netherlands have recently stopped weapon sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, but many others continue to sell weapons.
Who does China sell weapons to?
To the United Arab Emirates. So, this is a point that I want to make because for many Yemenis, it really makes no sense that the United States is helping Saudi Arabia, given Saudi Arabia's relationship with Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Okay? And given the United States' goals of trying to get rid of Al-Qaeda in Yemen through drone strikes that have been going on for the, you know, past decade or so. So the BBC actually recorded troops from Saudi-led coalition forces and Al-Qaeda militias working together against the Houthis. This is a snapshot from a video. They recorded video. And Frontline did a documentary too, and you can see evidence there. It's no secret in Yemen that whenever convenient, the Saudi-led coalition works with Al-Qaeda against the Houthis. President Hadi, the UN-recognized president of Yemen, whose term expired and somehow he's still stuck being our president, he has appointed Naif al-Qaisi, who is a US-designated terrorist, as a governor of one of the provinces in Yemen. And there are many more links between Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, and the Saudi-led coalition, and I've just listed a couple of sources here that, you know, I can share with you if anybody's interested, if you want to dig further into this. So for many Yemenis, it's a very confusing thing. The only people who are known to fight Al-Qaeda successfully were the Houthis, and now the Houthis are busy fighting everybody else. So what has this war done? What is the impact of the war on Yemen after 3 years? Well, if you look at who controls what, you see that after 3 years, this map really hasn't changed that much. Houthis still control that green area is where about 80% of the population lives, and it's mostly under Houthi control. and the Saudis share the rest of Yemen with Al-Qaeda. And if this looks a bit familiar, you can see that it's along the regional north-south divide. Because what happened in southern Yemen, he saw this as an opportunity to rid themselves of northern Yemen. And so they thought, maybe the Saudis will help us secede from Yemen when all is said and done. And so they supported the Saudi-led coalition. Well, now it seems that Saudi Arabia has an agenda, and United Arab Emirates has a different agenda in Yemen. And the UAE has been trying to, you know, foster this separatist movement, whereas Saudi Arabia is still trying to hope for a united Yemen under President Hadi. The impact of the war on people, on people's everyday lives, has been substantial. Today, over 80% of the population needs humanitarian aid. I won't show any pictures. They're too painful to see. But I'll show you some figures. The UN stopped counting the deaths resulting from airstrikes in January 2017, even though there are airstrikes every single day, including an airstrike today that killed 14 people. But the official figure is 10,000 people killed. 16.4 million lack access to health care. Saudi Arabia has bombed most hospitals. About 45% of hospitals remain functioning, somewhat functioning. Yemen experienced the world's worst cholera outbreak, with over 1 million people infected. At the height of the cholera outbreak in Haiti, which I'm sure you've heard about, it was about 700,000 people. There are over 3 million civilians who are displaced internally because there's nowhere to go. Have you heard of Yemeni refugees in Europe? Probably not, because there's a land, air, and sea blockade that's keeping people in the country. 24.3 million people, about 90%, lack access to electricity. So most of Yemen has had no electricity for the past 3 years. They use solar power, they use generators, which, I mean, Saudi Arabia bombed a generator plant yesterday. Yemen was already water-stressed before this conflict even began, and now 15.7 million people lack access to clean water. Just in 2016 and 2017, 113,000 children died of malnutrition and preventable diseases like cholera and diphtheria. And millions lack access to fuel. Think about how important fuel is to our everyday lives. Millions lack access to it, and many cities have run out of fuel entirely. So when the UN says that this is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, it is not an exaggeration. There's a land, air, and sea blockade, like I said, and Saudi Arabia has admitted to be using starvation as a weapon of war. This is, in case you didn't know, a war crime, among many other war crimes that they're committing.
Who was enforcing the blockade?
The Saudi Arabians and the United States. And I think Egyptian Navy as well. So I showed you pictures of Sana'a earlier. On the left is a before and the right is an after. This is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. When health services are crippled, people have to dig their own relatives from underneath the rubble. This is a 3,000-year-old dam that also remained, you know, has not remained unscathed by Saudi Arabia. They've damaged several UNESCO World Heritage Sites and other ancient sites in Yemen. And like I said, they've destroyed many hospitals, including 4 separate bombings on Doctors Without Borders hospitals in Yemen. This is after they were giving them coordinates, exact coordinates, to say we are Doctors Without Borders. Schools, homes, markets, water plants, and even funeral homes like this have been targeted by the Saudi-led coalition. This particular bomb killed 150 people. They were attending a funeral. So let's talk about the U.S. role in Yemen. Going back to the map of Yemen, Yemen controls Bab al-Mandab Strait, where 3.4 or 3.8 million barrels of oil travel each day. This is Saudi oil, right? And so it has a strategic location. This isn't very many millions barrels of oil compared to other places, but it's still significant enough that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia want to maintain control over that area. Sometimes you hear about Yemen in the news when there's a drone strike. Like in January 2017, when Trump was first elected, there was an incident there that, you know, there was a U.S. SEAL, Navy SEAL involved. So that is a different front of the war. So the U.S. is involved in two ways. One is mostly drone strikes on suspected terrorists, which, by the way, include American citizens in Yemen. And the second is assisting the Saudi-led coalition, which is what's been going on in the last 3 years. This is a picture of children holding fragments of a U.S. bomb that was dropped in their neighborhood. So the U.S. has continued, of course, to supply weapons in the hundreds of billions worth ever since the Obama administration. And this is just, you know, you hear sometimes about U.S. involvement being that they're, you know, in the sense that they're providing weapons, but that's not the whole story. So the United States Army trains Saudi soldiers. They advise Saudi military personnel. They maintain, repair, and upgrade vehicles and aircraft. They provide courses on communication, navigation, and, quote, how to lead by example. This is from a U.S. Army article that was published in January of this year. There are 123 contracts with the Saudis that total $120 million per month.
So what kind of contracts are those, like training?
These are all the training and the advising and the repairing and all of that. And I think most significantly, the U.S. refuels Saudi jets mid-air as they're bombing all of these civilian targets that they've been bombing over the last 3 years. Simply put, Saudi cannot continue to wage war on Yemen without the significant support that they're receiving from the United States. So how are Yemenis resisting to the war? This is a crowd that showed up in the capital to commemorate the first year, the first anniversary, and we've seen crowds like this year after year after year. This is what Saudi Arabia says are rebels that they're trying to control. Well, it's millions and millions and millions of people who, even if they're not allied with the Houthis, do not want foreign intervention, do not want Saudi occupation or UAE occupation in their country. Here in the United States, there have been some really promising legislations introduced in both the House and the Senate and just in the last few months. So in October 2017, HCON Resolution 81 was introduced by Congressman Ro Khanna of California, and he invoked the War Powers Act, which meant that it had to go to a vote within 15 days. And instead, it was stripped of its privileged status and never went to a vote. Instead, they replaced it with another vote, with another bill that passed, but it overstated Iran's role in Yemen, and then they started talking about, well, let's sanction Iran some more because they're somehow involved in Yemen. It was non-binding. It did, however, acknowledge that the war, U.S. involvement in Yemen is without congressional support and approval. Then in February 2018, Senator Bernie Sanders introduced SJ Resolution 54, also invoked the War Powers Act. And he said, we believe that as Congress has not declared war or authorized military force in this conflict, the United States involvement in Yemen is unconstitutional and unauthorized, and U.S. military support of the Saudi coalition must end. Well, they decided to table it in the Senate. They didn't even vote on this bill. 44% voted not to table it. It doesn't mean that they if it had gone to a vote, that they would have voted for it. Going in, Bernie Sanders had 14 co-sponsors of the bill. So yes, 44% seems like a big deal, but let's remember that they were voting to not table the bill. In the end, 55% voted to table the bill, and that was that.
Those two senators, how did they vote?
Sorry, which two?
The ones on the paper on the side.
Oh,
Durbin and Duckworth.
Durbin voted, was in the 44. I think so was Duckworth.
Yes.
There was a lot of work from people in this room to try to get those two people, those two senators to vote yes, and it really, really made a difference. So I asked some Yemenis, I said to them, what would you want to tell an American audience? One person said, I want Americans to know that without U.S. government support, the Saudi regime is not able to launch the war and impose siege on Yemen. In every single Saudi war crime in Yemen, the U.S. government is involved. In Yemen, this is not just seen as a Saudi Arabian war on Yemen, this is seen as a U.S.-Saudi war in Yemen. In America, we don't even know where Yemen is. Another person says, if Yemenis survive U.S.-supported airstrikes, they'll die from lack of food or medicine. Put yourself in the shoes of the Yemeni population when your child sleeps without food and cannot find medicine. Yemeni civilians suffer the brunt of this war. 80% of civilians are suffering. The decision to stop the war is in the hands of the United States government first and foremost. So what can we do to help? We can call, we can write, we can email our representatives, because that's our best shot in this war, in this effort to bring about an end to the war. And here we're emphasizing that we don't want foreign intervention. We're not asking the U.S. government to get involved. We're asking them to not be involved in Yemen. There's a big difference. Ask them to either introduce or support legislation that aims to end U.S. involvement in Yemen. And tell them that this has to be happening right now. Yemen can't wait. 113,000 children died. We don't know how many people died in total from lack of food and medicine. If you want to learn more about the conflict, you can help increase public awareness, even if it's just talking to your friends and family about what's going on in Yemen, writing to your local paper, and connecting with groups like the Chicago Area Peace Action. For the longest time, I was doing this work on my own. Once I connected with the Massachusetts Peace Action, you know, there's a lot more people who are doing similar work that you can connect with, and you can, you know, join forces and get more ideas and get involved that way. So please do if you can. If you'd like to learn more, I help run this page on Twitter. You don't have to have a Twitter account to view this. You just type at Yemen Source, and you can follow, you know, what's going on in Yemen from Yemenis. If you'd like to donate, Doctors Without Borders continues to operate in Yemen. I've set up this page specifically so that it's earmarked for Yemen, and I've been fundraising. So if you'd like to help, this is a way to donate to Yemen. Some closing thoughts. I just want to emphasize that without U.S. and U.K. support, Saudi cannot continue to wage war in Yemen. They depend on us for the weapons. They depend on us for the logistical training. They depend on us for the targeting. They depend on us for mid-air refueling. And so how much longer can they really wage this war without all that support? Not very long. I'm not affiliated with any group in Yemen. I think everybody has blood on their hands, and they all need to answer to the Yemeni population for everything that they've done in Yemen. But that's for us to decide. That's for Yemenis in Yemen to decide, not for other people in the region or internationally to decide for them. And if you decide to help, your effort might take just a few minutes, but it really would make such a big difference in Yemenis' lives. And I'd like to thank all the co-sponsors for hosting me and for having this event and for all the incredible work that goes on. And this is my contact information if you want more information or if you want to connect with me. So I'll go ahead and take questions right now. I do have references to everything I've said, so if you want to follow up and just, you know, want me to send you some of my references, I'm more than happy to do that. But I'll take any questions. Yes, in the back.
Could you go back to drone strikes?
So the question is, who is the U.S. targeting with drone strikes in Yemen? And anybody that they suspect is a member of Al-Qaeda in Yemen. It's called AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. That's who the drone strikes target. And so sometimes they're civilians, sometimes they're children, sometimes they are actually Al-Qaeda, but they're not afforded any kind of trial or anything like that. They're executions by drone.
So they're not the Houthis, and they're...
No, they don't target the Houthis by drone.
They're targeting the allies of Saudi Arabia who they support.
Essentially.
Do you think U.S. is supporting Saudi Arabia because of the oil?
Right. I mean, Saudi Arabia, you know, a lot of that oil is Saudi Arabian oil. Yemen is a strategic location for that purpose. But also, we're the poor neighbor to the south who has not had a kingdom or a sultanate or an emirate. You know, it's the Republic of Yemen. It's had a democracy. You know, maybe it's a failed revolution, but it was a revolution. You know, failed attempts at democracy, but there were attempts. And Yemen is really the only example in those countries surrounding Saudi Arabia, including Saudi Arabia, of an example of that. So I don't think, you know, they want to maintain control over what happens in Yemen. They don't want it to get too chaotic because then it's a problem at their border. But they want to maintain some kind of control.
I've heard that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is different.
I mean, some things that Al-Qaeda does, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula will be like, whoa, that's too extreme for us, yes. But they are terrorists. They bomb innocent civilians just because they may have a seat as a governor or, you know, as a negotiator or whatever it is, official, you know, links to the government of Yemen. It doesn't make them any less of a problem for Yemeni society. Yes?
Foreign intervention. What do you think of get from the in terms of the violence and the starvation?
So the starvation is a direct result of the foreign intervention. The people who are starving kids are the Saudi-led coalition by blockading all the ports of entry and exit into Yemen. And so prior to the war, yes, there were conflicts, but it was never to this extent. It was never to this, you know, the destruction was never to this extreme. The malnutrition was there, never to this extreme. The damage that airstrikes cause are because of the foreign intervention. Yemenis don't even have they've disabled the Yemeni air force, and so they can't even hit the missiles back, right? And so there's no defense system in Yemen to do that. So the airstrikes have caused huge destruction to the country, infrastructure, bridges, roads, schools, all of that. And it's just turned a poor country into a total humanitarian crisis. Yes?
Do you think Yemen would be better off if it had never attempted to unify?
I think the unification was premature. I think it needed some time, yeah, before, you know. My mom had grew up in South Yemen under British rule, and she told me that, you know, the dream was always to unify with Yemen. But it was just a dream. The populations were very different. They had gone through very different modern histories. Their needs were very different. Literacy in the South was much higher than literacy in the North. Education in the South was much higher. You know, even religious affiliations became very different in the South and the North. So there were very different populations trying to unite very quickly. And so I think maybe if they had just given it some time for things to settle down in either country first before they tried to unify, it may have been a better choice. Yes?
You say that at the beginning the revolution was peaceful, going back to 2011. Is there any remnant of that group or whoever, you know, of that revolution still in Yemen?
I think people are tired of war, and many people who joined the 2011 protesters say, well, you know what, Saleh wasn't so bad after all. Yes, he was corrupt. Yes, he had, you know, driven the country to poverty and to the extreme poverty that it was living in. But at least we had functioning, you know, schools and hospitals and, you know, institutions. At least we were able to come in and out of the country and not starve to death without being able to leave. And so I think many people have changed their minds. Many people see it as a mistake. Of course, they couldn't predict what could have happened next. But yes, sir.
You said that Iran influence was overblown.
Yes.
But so my question is, what has Iran's
involvement been in Yemen?
But beyond that, is there any involvement whatsoever of Israel, Russia, China, or any other major actors in the world?
Israel, not that I know of. Israel, not that I know of. Russia tried to play a peacekeeping role at some point. The Russian ambassador was the only foreign ambassador left in Sana'a for the longest time. But they didn't play any major role. China, not as far as I know. Iran is what you hear about a lot in the news. Just type Yemen and you'll see U.S. or Iran-backed Houthis. I mean, that's just become standard. That's the narrative. Like I said earlier, this connection began with Saleh. And, you know, he tried to get the Americans to help him with the Houthi problem. And so he thought, well, if I tell the Americans that Iran is involved, maybe they'll be responsive. And the U.S. ambassador at the time did his own investigation to see where the Houthis' weapons were coming from, because Saleh was saying that they were coming from Iran. And they found that they were all coming from the Yemeni army through the black market. I mean, I joke about this, but when we were kids, we used to say, well, if you want to buy a tank in Yemen, you can buy a tank in Yemen. The Houthis ended up forming a relationship with Iranians. The Iranians very much see themselves as allies of the Houthis, and they probably definitely provide support on the media front. They, you know, at times before this war, before this intervention, there had been advisors that were exchanged between, you know, the Houthi advisors and Iranian advisors. They were meeting and discussing things. But currently, Yemen is under blockade by the most powerful countries in the world, and we're led to believe that somehow Iran is smuggling missiles to Yemen through the U.S.-Saudi blockade on everything around the whole country. So that makes no sense. There's been no evidence of that. Nikki Haley, you know, will show a missile and say, this is Iranian. It's not. It's from Yemen. They've not provided any. They've tried at the beginning of the war, an Iranian ship tried to provide some humanitarian assistance, and the Saudis blocked them, and so they went back. So really, they're not involved. You won't find military, you know, Iranian personnel on the ground. If they were involved, do you think that at least it provide the Houthis with anti-missile aircraft? But we don't even have that. And so it's a shaky argument, but it's one that has solidified because that's what the Saudis are saying they're there for. Question in the back.
So the United States isn't just helping to arm Saudi Arabia. The U.S. military plays an active role.
Yes, which is why Senator Bernie Sanders invoked the War Power Resolution. He's saying that the U.S. is at war in Yemen without congressional support.
And then what the U.S. is saying is that, like, these drone strikes they're doing are to target al-Qaeda, but the Saudi-led coalition works with al-Qaeda?
Yep. Well, the U.S. won't recognize that the Saudi-led coalition is working with al-Qaeda. That narrative isn't very convenient, despite the evidence.
Is the origin of al-Qaeda the United States?
I mean, you could say that. It's definitely Saudi Arabian. Any terrorist group you can point to, you'll trace their ideology back to Wahhabi Islam, which is exported and invented and exported to the rest of the world by Saudi Arabia.
So it's not just, oh, we're supporting Saudi Arabia's interests in Yemen. We're also kind of trying to advance our own.
Right, so the U.S.'s own interests, so after 9/11, Congress approved, waging war in certain countries, in any country really, under the fighting terrorism notion. So that's where the drone strikes go, and that's why it's not talked about, and Congress is not going to challenge that because it's technically has congressional support.
Is that what Bernie Sanders is talking
about? No, Bernie Sanders is talking about the last 3 years, the U.S. involvement in Yemen in the last 3 years, since March 26, 2015, has been unconstitutional because they're helping Saudi Arabia wage war in Yemen. And I think essentially they're just getting paid really handsomely for it. So I couldn't find a figure about how many billions of dollars in weapon sales, but they're in the hundreds of billions of dollars under both Obama's administration and Trump's administration. And then, you know, with all these contracts totaling $120 million a month, and that's probably going to increase now under Trump because Trump, one of his, platform during his elections was saying, well, why are we helping the Saudis and they're not paying for it? Okay, well, now they're just going to pay more for what the U.S. is doing to help Saudi Arabia in the region.
Yeah, didn't he just push some big deal with Saudi?
Yeah. The prince came here. He went coast to coast. We protested in Boston, and some friends protested in Seattle and California as well. But, yeah, he's here showing himself as, CBS did an interview with him, and they called 60 Minutes, and they called him an emancipator of women, right, because he... Because he allowed women to drive. My goodness, what a concept in 2018. And he's just opened up the first movie theater in 35 years. Wow, such a revolutionary. By the way, women are allowed to drive in every other country, right? Every other country in the world. And, I mean, there was never a ban against it, right? So we're seeing him as a reformer, as somebody who's really, you know, he has this vision 2030, and he's trying to... you know, get rid of corruption by arresting all his cousins and putting them in the Ritz Hotel. Well, he's spending $220 million a day bombing Yemen. And so he had to fill those coffers somehow, right? But he went unchallenged in the U.S.
Yes. They really prettified.
Yes. He's on the cover of Time.
I was really interested in your saying that North Yemen was better educated.
South Yemen.
But at some point, that country or that section was more well-educated
yes.
than the other. And I wonder if you could explain that. It's very anti-intuitive to me that that would be true.
So the South, the British ruled from Aden. And wherever the British go, they try to create, you know, services that would help them. They're not helping the population. They just want a nice place with, you know, schools and roads and all of that. And so Yemen, South Yemen was more developed than Northern Yemen. And with that came education. And so there was a huge anti-illiteracy campaign that my dad was part of in the 70s, and they would go to remote villages, and they could do that because it was a smaller population. And they'd go to remote villages, and they'd educate people, and, you know, they'd enroll them in schools and whatnot. And so you ended up with a population here in the South that was more educated than the Northern population, which was oppressed by the rulers at the time for many, many years, and we're just starting to come out of that oppression.
So the British never occupied North Yemen?
They never occupied North Yemen, no.
Can you say something about the detention centers?
Yes. So the UAE is seeing itself as the police in the region. They're trying to present themselves as a force to be reckoned with, not just Saudi Arabia being the bully in the region. They also want to be the bully in the region. And so they've taken on the cause of Al-Qaeda, even though, like I said, the coalition that they're part of is working with Al-Qaeda at times and has worked with Al-Qaeda at times. So the UAE is now, the UAE and Saudi Arabia occupy southern Yemen. I think I showed a map over here. And, you know, those red and blue areas. And anybody suspected of being Al-Qaeda or being, you know, whatever the UAE deems a terrorist, they are arrested, they're disappeared. There are some really horrific, horrific stories of what they're doing to prisoners in these secret secret underground prisons. But they're an ally of our, you know, of the United States, and so we're not going to talk about that in the media, right? We're not going to challenge that. Migrants in Aden have been also put through really horrific things. I was reading reports and I had to stop because the descriptions were just so awful, right? And again, that's Saudi-controlled, Saudi-UAE-controlled territory where all of this is happening.
And something about Taiz?
Yes, Taiz is a battleground. Half of it is controlled, I have family in Taiz, half of it is controlled by the Houthis, half of it is controlled by the Saudi-led coalition, which includes Al-Qaeda and all of those sorts of people. And that city has seen really horrible attacks over the last 3 years. It's difficult for foreigners to come into Yemen to be able to assess what's happening. And by the way, countries like the Netherlands and Canada even had been proposing an unbiased, you know, investigation into Yemen. And everybody in Yemen was supporting that. Even if they're going to point at fingers at Houthis and say, well, you've committed war crimes, everybody was supporting that except for the Saudis and their Hadi-backed government. And they kept, you know, slamming any kind of deal that would go through in the UN. And they ended up investigating themselves time and time again. And they say, okay, well, we'll investigate what happened. Guess what? It's all Houthis' fault, so we've done nothing wrong.
I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the history of the ports of Aden and Djibouti.
So the Saudi-led coalition is controlling the port of Aden. So right here, the port of Aden, Saudi-led coalition is controlling that. Mukalla, which is toward the east, is where some oil exports actually take place. That area is between Al-Qaeda and UAE and Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia and UAE come and they say, oh, you guys got to leave now, and then they leave, and then, you know, they assert control, and then sometimes Al-Qaeda is the one that's exporting the oil. So that region is back and forth between the coalition and Al-Qaeda. But the Houthis control the port of, actually there's, currently I think the Houthis control the port over there, Bab al-Mandab. But that goes back and forth between the Houthis and the coalition as well. The Houthis have given up on Aden. It's already in the hands of the Saudi Arabians, just the
European powers.
I mean, they were much more powerful before than they are now. They're not as powerful or as important as they used to be. But you know, if the Saudis are controlling that, then the U.S. is also kind of controlling that. So everything is okay from that perspective.
What were the main things that were coming in through the ports to sustain the Yemeni population, and what would be the most important things to come through first? Like, is it food? Is it fuel? Is it medicine? What?
All of the above. So Yemen used to import 90% of its food prior to the war, and mostly through the port of Hodeidah.
From where?
From Saudi Arabia, mostly. And so there's no commercial shipping anymore. The Saudis are blocking everything. In November, you may have heard about Yemen in the news because you may have heard that, you know, Saudi Arabia has blocked it. 60 Minutes did that segment. They failed to mention U.S. involvement, of course, but they mentioned that the food's not coming in. They didn't mention Saudi Arabia much either. But that what happened in November is that they imposed a total blockade. prior to November, for the past 3 years, they've blockaded Yemen, but they allow certain UN ships in, certain Doctors Without Borders ships in, they allow some medicines into the country, some food. People are still starving to death. But in November, they decided it was going to be a total blockade, and they've done that for like 2 weeks. I don't know how many people died in those 2 weeks waiting for food. And so, yeah, Yemen without import and export is literally starving to death. So food, medicine, water, there's no water in the country. Mismanagement, and it's dry, and you know, there are no natural wells left, and so people are just drinking contaminated water wherever they can find it.
Saudi Arabia and the U.S. are blockading what's orange and yellow there?
Yep.
Not blue.
No, they allow certain things through the blue areas, so you won't find people starving to death in the blue areas. But again, only 20% of the population lives there. Yes, go ahead.
Yes. The role of Egypt here, a little bit more about Egypt.
So I know that it's hard to find information about the role of Egypt. I know that they have, the Egyptian Navy is helping impose the blockade, but I don't know much more than that about Egyptian, the role of Egypt. Was there a question in the back? So the Houthis have nothing to do. They will not answer to U.S. or any foreigners, really. They have a relationship with Iran, but even that relationship is strained. For example, when the Houthis at some point during this war were trying to negotiate directly with the Saudi Arabians in Saudi Arabia, and some Iranian general said, oh, if you need advisors, we're happy to send. And the Houthis were very offended at that and said, this is not your war. Stay out of it. We don't want any advice. Iranian officials say that they advised the Houthis not to take over Sana'a. Houthis ignored it. Because again, part of their rise to power and the movement is that they don't want foreign intervention in their country. But Al-Qaeda, you know, in Yemen, sometimes they're Al-Qaeda, sometimes they're official members of the government. And so it's difficult there to, it's much more of a fluid relationship.
Our reason for being there, Saudi's reason, is to fight the
Saudis are trying to fight Houthis. Because if Houthis rise to power, there will no longer be Saudi influence in Yemen. And they've enjoyed influence in Yemen, you know, for the past 100 years. So that's their objective.
What do you think could really produce permanent peace in Yemen? Do you think the United Nations has a role in that?
I hope that the United Nations has a role in that. So far, it doesn't look like there is a role for the United Nations, because the United Nations, under Resolution 2216, approves of the Saudi intervention in Yemen. And so at some point in 2016, the United Nations designated Saudi as, you know, as a child killer. It's a shame list, right? They put them on the list of child killers because of their, you know, they're murdering children in Yemen. And within 72 hours, they took them off that list. And the general, Ban Ki-moon at the time, made an announcement. He said, I've had to make these very difficult decisions because the Saudis threatened to pull aid away from Gaza and Syria and other programs. And so he took them, removed them from the list.
Was this actually voted on by the General Assembly? That sounds hard to believe.
That is, it's so incredibly hard to believe what's going on in Yemen. But yes, he put them on the list and took them out within 72 hours. His successor ended up putting them back on the list. So I think currently they're on the list. But just recently, 2 weeks ago, the Saudis met with the current UN Secretary General, and he was praising them left, right, and center for their incredible donation for the humanitarian aid in Yemen. Right? And so, you know, there's nobody in the UN really representing Yemeni interests. The people we have in the UN, Yemenis in the UN, are based out of Saudi Arabia. They're getting, you know, their salaries are from Saudi Arabian government, and they are perpetuating this agenda of war on Yemen. Yes?
Yeah.
Look, Saudi Arabia has no moral authority, right? Ask the average person down the street, tell them, do you support Saudi Arabia? What is there to support? 15 out of the 19 hijackers,
right,
including Osama bin Laden, are Saudi Arabian. Every terrorist group you can think of traces its roots back to Saudi Arabia. Women are oppressed in that country. Minorities are oppressed in that country. You have a very corrupt, you know, royal family that's just enriching itself at the expense of its people, right? What is there to support? They have no moral authority or backing, but they have a lot of money. Yeah, and civilians get caught in all of this, and, you know, they lose their lives and their livelihoods, and there's nobody to stand up for them. There's a question there in the back.
This whole situation is heavily influenced by, like, U.S. arms dealers, weapon makers. I'm sure it's a chance for, like, special operations.
So if people, if the U.S. government really cared about the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, they wouldn't have been involved in this war. There is no worse humanitarian crisis on Earth today. Right? So we can't go about it by trying to, you know, tug at heartstrings. The only way really forward is going through the legal system. This is unconstitutional. We're there without congressional approval. How do you even, you know, approve a war like that that serves us nothing? In fact, it harms our interests in the region because now we have groups like Al-Qaeda that have become much more powerful in the last 3 years. And so really talking to our representatives and helping them understand that even if they think Iran is involved, they shouldn't be involved in Yemen.
Yes,
the drones.
Yeah. And the other is the aid that we're giving to the Saudi government, and that's what you're saying to focus on is being
as a second point. Yes, we're helping them blockade a country and starve its people to death. We're helping them bomb civilians by refueling midair. We're selling billions and billions of weapons to those countries involved in Yemen. And that's really what we should be challenging. There are people challenging the drone wars in Yemen as well.
Let's not concede the legality of the drone wars.
Yeah. So just because they're happening and they're legal doesn't mean we stop, you know, fighting against them. We have to continue also fighting. But right now, what's causing the most impact, you know, if we're going to put our efforts into something, really we should be looking at what we've been doing the last 3 years.
What exactly is the threat to Saudi Arabia, this country?
There is no threat. The Houthis never occupied.
Woke up one day and said, let's bomb them for fun?
Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman essentially did that. I know this is difficult to understand and even believe, but he came into the world stage. Nobody really knew how old he was. If you remember, January 2015, Deputy Crown Prince. Nobody knows how old he is. Nobody knew if he was married or not. Nobody, like, he hadn't, you know, he wasn't foreign educated, so he didn't have those credentials. And he was placed in this position of Deputy Crown Prince and Defense Minister. So he saw Yemen as an opportunity to prove his, you know, his might. Unfortunately, extremely misguided. He, you know, if you look at the cables between, or interviews, you know, U.S. generals who have spoken to, Foreign Policy did an article, a really extensive article on this. And the understanding was that he was going to bomb Yemen 2 weeks, 6 weeks max, and he's going to be out of there. He's just going to assert control in Yemen, you know, replace Hadi into power because Hadi is a Saudi puppet, and that was going to be it. You know what they called their operation in Yemen? Operation Decisive Storm. Decisive Storm. Decisive implies what? Right? So this really was supposed to be, in their eyes, an in-and-out kind of mission. And then 2 months later, they changed it to Operation Restoring Hope, and nothing changed. So it's just a PR thing for them. He got stuck in this war, and he doesn't know how to get out of it. He saw an opportunity in December to throw his support behind Saleh, who had been allied with the Houthis, and that ended in a couple of days with Saleh's murder by the Houthis. So they were trying. They were hoping that they thought maybe this could be our out. We can say, oh, we were never against Saleh. We were always against the Houthis. But that didn't work out very well for them either. So, you know, he can't. There's no saving face. So I don't think they ever intended to govern, which is why when Hadi resigned, so they were, when they marched to Sana'a and they took over Sana'a, they had surrounded the presidential palace and were trying to force Hadi to do something. Oh, you know, you've been, you know, your term expired and you haven't done anything. We're going to sit here and watch you do it, right? He ended up fleeing to Aden. They chased him to Aden because they weren't trying to rule Sana'a. They were trying to, you know, form this unity government so that they could have a say just like everybody else. Right, the Muslim Brotherhood of Yemen, the Salah Party, the Saleh's Party, the Southern Separatists. They were trying to have some control in Yemen like everybody else, but I don't think they ever intended to govern. They're fighters. They do that best. In all of 2017, there was exactly one report in MSNBC about Yemen. And I've asked people, you know, Chris Hayes and other people on Twitter who are concerned about Yemen, and they retweet about Yemen, are you going to have something on your show? Are you going to have a segment? They just ignore, right? Nobody wants to touch Yemen because you cannot justify what's happening in Yemen. You cannot tell an American audience about what we're doing in Yemen and gain support, right?
The same with BBC.
The same with BBC. At least BBC has a Yemeni woman there who works for them, and you know, she's managed to go to Yemen and film, and yes, the news is still covered in all this bias, but it's at least they're more aware.
Yeah, I'd like to point out, I personally invited WBEZ.
I was interviewed in Boston when we were doing the protest, and that didn't even get published. There's going to be an anti-war march, and I'll be speaking for 5 minutes at that rally as well to try to raise more awareness. But the problem is just people, average Americans. You know, I grew up in Yemen, Canada, India, but really Americans are wonderful people, right? Good-hearted people who don't want, you know, this to happen in their name, but they just don't know about it. When it's not on the news, they don't know about it. So, again, it's difficult because of how much influence Saudi and UAE have in D.C., but, you know, senators, and this is across the board, Republican, Democrat, Independents, Bernie Sanders, Chris Murphy has been vocal against this since day one, and so has Rand Paul. Rand Paul has been against this since day one. Chris Murphy said, you know, there's a U.S. fingerprint on every war crime in Yemen, right? And, you know, I was watching HCON or S Resolution 54, you know, and people and the senators there were showing pictures. They're like, we're starving those kids. We are doing this to Yemen. It's not just happening. We are doing this. And so, yes, there is a small group of senators, and 14 co-sponsored that bill with Bernie Sanders. But, you know, now what? Let's keep that going, right? So let's not wait another 3 years before we have a similar resolution in the Senate. I think we have to keep talking about it because it'll more and more support will be forged for it. We could put efforts into the media. So I don't know, how many shares does Saudi have in Fox News? A lot, right? How many shares do they have in CNN? I mean, I really, if you want to learn about, you know, they say 60 Minutes had the audacity to say, oh, you know, we couldn't get into Yemen, but we're reporting from Djibouti. There are people reporting in Yemen that you can pay. Right? There's still internet over there. And so they know what's happening. They're choosing not to broadcast this. And so let's maybe then go to the legislators. For pressure from the people on the streets. We have to let more people know about what we're doing in Yemen. Yes? SJ Resolution 54. There's, I think the UK has also a lot of coverage. So, you know, organizations like Oxfam, which have been, you know, they're British and they've been working in Yemen very closely. Save the Children, they've been very vocal against this. I think a lot of people end up, you know, just kind of downplaying what's happening by saying, well, Houthis are just as bad as Saudi Arabians, right? And then, okay, where do we go from there, right? Or just presenting it as a civil war, you know, of equal proportions, two sides that are equally matched, right? But yeah, we got to work with people across not just this country, but, you know, in other places. And I do all of my Yemen work on Twitter. I don't talk about anything else on Twitter other than this. And that's another way of, you know, getting to speak with radio stations in South Africa, for example, or, you know, wherever to try to raise more awareness about this. We're not the good guys. It's really just, there's no other way to say it. We're not the good guys in Yemen. So there are huge Yemeni populations in New York, in Dearborn, Detroit area, and in Oakland, California. Most people support the intervention. And I get called, you know, I get accused of being a Houthi supporter and, you know, all the time for speaking out against Saudi intervention in Yemen. Many of the Yemeni diaspora in the U.S. is affiliated with the Islah Party in Yemen. And, you know, the Islah Party, up until Qatar was involved in the war, they were for the war. Now that Qatar is out, they're like, oh, we shouldn't really be doing this. And so there's a lot of splintering. There's splinters in families. There are members of my family that support the Saudi-led intervention. And so it's really a war that's divided a lot of people. But in Yemen, most people are against the Saudi-led intervention, no matter where their political affiliations lie. So it's difficult to do this work because I feel like I know a couple of people that I can work with. One's in Seattle, one's in California. The question is that I had mentioned that many of the Yemeni diaspora is involved with Islah in Yemen, the political party that's the Muslim Brotherhood of Yemen, kind of. I don't know. I think it comes down to regional affiliations. You know, where are people migrating out of, and, you know, what are the political affiliations there? My being from Aden, you know, people automatically assume that because I'm from Aden, I support the Saudi-led intervention. And so it's a bit surprising when they hear that I'm from Aden and I'm actually vehemently against the Saudi-led intervention, even if I think the South should secede. And so I think many people just follow, you know, regional politics, and they bring that here. So in a way, they see them as, so first of all, many, so Sana'a's population was 3 million, now it's 6 million, because most people have gone to Sana'a, because Sana'a is the safest place to be. Because yes, there are airstrikes every single day, but there's no Al-Qaeda. Why is there no Al-Qaeda? Because of the Houthis. And so in a way, they appreciate that the Houthis have brought the security, but they also oppose them because they're either loyal to President Saleh or they're just, you know, the Houthis obviously have blood on their hands as well. And so people are just kind of tired of all of these different factions vying for power. They don't really, if there was an election, if you had asked me in December 2017, who would people vote for if there was an election, I would have said President Saleh. Now President Saleh is dead. So I have no idea. It's a big question mark. I think the Houthi support has grown over the years, but you know, I don't know to what extent. A lot of people also just don't want to talk about it, so it's difficult.
Wouldn't there be a certain common ground about
why should civilians pay the price?
No.
I think a lot of people, so if you hear Mohammed bin Salman speak, he'll tell you that the Houthis are blockading aid from Yemen, in Yemen. He says that openly. He says, oh, the situation in Yemen is so terrible, the Houthis are blocking aid. Says the man controlling land, sea, and air, you know, in Yemen. And so civilians pay the price, yes, but, you know, we can't even get an agreement that the Saudis are doing what they're doing.
Well, I think what he means is, you know, if my opponents didn't exist, there would be no blockade.
Yeah, so he says, yeah, we're trying to starve the Houthis. Well, you're starving all of Yemen. It's not, the Houthis are not the only one relying on imports and aid. Right? All of Yemen is relying on that. So they say, yeah, we're starving the Houthis. They're starving Yemen. They say we're striking, you know, our airstrikes against the Houthis. Well, that's just code work for Yemeni civilians. Right? So it's been, honestly, it's been a very frustrating 3 years.
Without the U.S. Navy's involvement, would the Saudis be able to affect?
The Saudis couldn't even protect their own capital from Houthi missiles. They were shooting anti-aircraft missiles and they bombed themselves. And so this just happened a month ago. I'm not joking. There's video evidence of this. And Reuters wrote about it. So the Houthis depend on, or sorry, the Saudi Arabians depend on U.S. support, you know, substantial U.S. support. Military, blockade, intelligence, training, equipment. The Saudi military doesn't have troops on the ground in Yemen, okay? You will not find a Saudi soldier in Yemen. You know who you'll find? Senegalese, Sudanese mercenaries, Blackwater operatives, Australians, Colombians, Yemenis that they've paid off. They don't send their own troops to Yemen. So they can't even send troops to Yemen, right? So they can't operate their aircraft. They can't maintain their aircraft. They can't do any logistical support. They have UK and US personnel in their targeting rooms, right? So they literally cannot continue to wage war without US and UK support. So the better question is, what are the sources that Iran is involved? Sometimes you'll read that a U.S. or an Iranian ship was intercepted with weapons, and then the next, and it's all over the news. And then the next day, oh, that was actually a Somali ship. Oops. Nobody really covers that part. You'll find it somewhere in the internet, but it's not highlighted. I think the thing that makes most sense is just how. When food and water and medicine and doctors can't enter the country and people can't leave, how are Iranian weapons coming into the country? And so yes, there is moral support. There is support in the media. They may be Skyping with Houthis and telling them what to do, sure, right? But where is that significant military support? It's just not there. Iran has no interest in Yemen. That's the bottom line. They have interest in Syria. They are in Syria. There's no question about that. But in Yemen, okay, what is there for Iran? Iran at the end operates for its own interests, right? What is there in Yemen for Iran? Nothing. Iran controls its own port where more oil goes through Hormuz. But historically, Iran's never been involved in Yemen, right? So, sure, maybe they have some stake. I think it's a problem they don't want to touch with a 10-foot pole, right? And so it's really counter to Iran's interests to be involved in Yemen in any significant way. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being here. And thank you. I know you're going to go and you're going to speak to somebody about this, and maybe you'll call your, while you're calling your representatives to talk to them about Jessica, maybe you'll mention Yemen as well.